From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the program, a new biennial state budget is signed into law. Rob Henkin of Milwaukee's Public Policy Forum puts it into context. Then one of the artists from the 30 Americans exhibition at the Milwaukee Art Museum turns the visual language of advertising into fine art.
Advertising is the most ubiquitous language in the world. Why is it only used by a select group of corporations to speak to all of us? Why can't we use that same language to speak about other things that the corporations couldn't and shouldn't, you know, speak about?
And on the 150th anniversary of the Battle of Gettysburg, we honor Wisconsin's contributions to the Union cause.
We can honestly say here in Wisconsin that the Iron Brigade saved this republic. They weren't the only ones that did it, but without them, I don't see the Battle of Gettysburg being won.
Lake Effect comes your way next. First, the news. Welcome to Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. It's great to have your company this morning. Governor Scott Walker signed the biennial state budget into law on Sunday. The governor used his substantial line item veto power to eliminate 58 items from the document, but most of the $68 billion package remained intact from the form passed easily by the state assembly and narrowly by the Senate. The budget includes an income tax cut, a limit to property tax increases, a freeze on state university tuition, and an expansion of the state's voucher program for private schools. Rob Henkin is the president of the nonpartisan Milwaukee-based Public Policy Forum. 2 years ago, he described the governor's previous budget as a living experiment in the principles of trying to stimulate economic growth while reducing taxes. Henkin joins Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke now to assess where that experiment is and to put the new budget into context.
Well, I think there's two different ways of looking at that question. First of all, in terms of the economy for the state as a whole, I frankly think it's too early to tell. We tend to put so much emphasis on microeconomic policies like tax reductions, et cetera. I think where this is really an interesting case study, however, is that, of course, the income tax cuts are in this budget, so we don't know the impact yet. The property tax reductions were accompanied by some significant cuts in compensation for public employees. So you have sort of a balancing act. To what extent was there a positive and stimulative impact from the fact that property taxes were not increasing as opposed to the dollars that were taken out of the economy by the cuts to public sector pay and benefits?
And to that end, the verdict is still out, you say?
Well, you know, clearly our state economy is lagging. There have been several reports that have come out recently that shows that even to the extent that we are growing again, we're not growing as well as other states. To me, the difficulty is to what extent can you attribute that to state budget policy as opposed to the variety of other major factors that impact economic growth?
So, is this similar to saying you can talk about climate change, but it's impossible to directly attribute a particular storm to global climate change in particular?
I think so. And I also think that, again, one of the more telling aspects of this is not just the impact on the growth of the economy, but what we have focused on at the Public Policy Forum is the impact on local government and school district services. And I think that from a budgetary perspective, we can look back at Act 10 and we can see that the combination of the state budget and the so-called tools that were given to local governments and school districts did indeed hold down property taxes, did indeed allow local governments and county governments and school districts to be able to withstand the major cuts in state aids and not have to diminish services by a great deal. But I would imagine, Mitch, that at the time 2 years ago, I also said that really this is going to be a multi-year analysis because the key question is to what extent can the cuts that were achieved in employee compensation, can those be made every year in order to offset the continued limits on the levy and the continued relatively slow growth of state aids?
Well, so then what do you see as the major story of this budget that has now been signed into law?
Well, I think that there are a few stories. I think it certainly continues. The governor, whether you love him or you hate him, I think that it's accurate to say that he's pretty open about what his views are and where he's going to go. And I think this is a continuation in terms of his state budget policies, cutting taxes, putting limits on the growth in revenue streams for local governments and school districts, putting lots of capital dollars into transportation infrastructure. I think these are all things we expected. Perhaps maybe what we didn't expect as much were the many policy items in this budget, particularly related to education. But then again, that's more for a conversation between budget policy wonks. I think the general thrust of the governor's education policies also came as advertised.
Well, so then where does this budget dovetail with this most recent study that the Forum has done on property taxes and property values?
Well, I think there's some several interesting connections here. First of all, we were very interested to see 2 years ago we found that property taxes in the region collectively, the seven-county southeast Wisconsin region, had actually gone down. Again, not too surprising given the state budget impacts, but we wanted to see in the second year what was going to be the impact. And what we see is that property taxes up about 1% across the region. Now, that's in the eye of the beholder. There are some who say any tax increase is unacceptable. I think 1%, even with today's low rate of inflation, is certainly a manageable increase. But I think what's going to be interesting as this plays out is to the extent that we're going to continue to see a limit in property tax increases, which, again, good news for the taxpayer, what does that mean for municipal and school district officials, given the fact that they have mostly enjoyed the benefits of the Act 10 tools? Where's that going to take us in the out years?
Well, and meanwhile, you've also found that the property values have apparently diminished considerably.
Yes. And so we were somewhat surprised, and this is not brand new data, but for 2012, property values in the region decreased more than 5%. And it looked in last year's report that the decline in property values had actually diminished. And so we asked the question in our 2012 report, had we hit bottom? And we thought the indication was we had. Well, it turns out in terms of property values, we have not. So as long as property values do not rebound to the extent that we're starting to see increased growth in sales tax revenue and other key revenue streams for governments, that's going to be a major problem for local governments because of the way that we raise revenue here in the state of Wisconsin for our local governments and school districts.
What do we know about why property values are continuing to fall?
Well, I guess my caveat before answering is that I think we're going to be getting some more recent data within the next couple months on what they've done since then. But hard to say. I think, here in Wisconsin, the good news is we tend to not have the bubbles that other parts of the country have. So we didn't take quite as big a hit as other places did in the real down years of the recession, 2009, 2010. I think we've been slower to rebound, however. And again, in a state where local governments are dependent upon property value growth for their key revenue streams, that's an issue.
Housing prices have been on their way up. And as you say, it's likely we're going to see new data on property values soon. Would you believe that property values have gone up a bit, or certainly the rate of decline has slowed?
Well, I think most, including myself, would be very surprised if the 2013 data doesn't show that the property values have gone up at least a little bit. But I don't think we're going to see the type of growth that perhaps one would have expected after 3 or 4 years of significant declines. I know the Legislative Fiscal Bureau, in doing some estimates for this state budget, was looking at maybe a 1 or 2% growth in property values across the state.
Well, and so the upshot for this is that that municipalities are anxious.
Anxious. And part of that is because of the levy limits that have been placed on them by the state budget. And so essentially they are capped by the growth of new construction. So to the extent that not only is there not a growth in values, but we're not seeing a lot of growth because of new construction occurring, that's going to put a limit on property tax levy increases for municipal governments and county governments.
Rob Henken, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Mitch.
Rob Henken is the president of the Milwaukee-based Public Policy Forum. He spoke with Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke. You can find a link to the forum's report on area property values and property taxes at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. We're just 2 short days away from July 4th, which means Independence Day fireworks, cookouts, and big sales at retailers. Lake Effect SAS Avi Lank may partake in the first 2 traditions, but as for the third, count him out.
I am a buyer, not a shopper. To me, malls are a convenience of modern life, like hospital emergency rooms. You're happy to use them when needed, but only when needed. I'll spend time buying a large item like a car, but I have never purchased consecutive vehicles from the same dealer, and I have no desire to build a relationship with someone who is selling me a commodity. Once I have determined what vehicle I want, I shop for it in the sense that I will engage in extended bargaining with a number of dealers, something the internet makes easy. But that is as far as my shopping goes. For anything less expensive than a refrigerator or a suit of clothes, I go into a store to buy. If the price is fair, then I hand over my money. If not, I will go to the retailer down the street or the hall. But I will not shop for such things. I decline to look upon acquiring them as entertainment or a swell way to spend leisure time. There are distinct advantages to this way of approaching consumerism. My credit card balance is manageable and my closet has little clutter. I can appreciate how retailers strive to make what they call the shopping experience as soothing and alluring as possible. Anything done well should be admired. Even dental work. But I do not let retail blandishments such as music and display distract me from why I entered the store, which is to buy something I predetermined. As much as I admire retailers for doing their job well, there is one tactic that, if tried, will make me remember a store and avoid it in the future. A checkout clerk asking me for my name, address, zip code, and/or my email. In recent weeks, I have encountered this in buying items as diverse as shoes, kitty litter, and kitchen gadgets. My initial impulse is to lie, but that would be wrong. So instead, I ask why they need to know. Usually I'm told that it is so I can be informed of future deals and bargains. One clerk says it was so that I could be sent catalogs. In other words, it is to foster a relationship, which is the last thing I want with a retailer. I also don't want to add to the bits of computerized data about me floating around in the ether of the internet. Every clerk, sorry, sales associate, I have run into will complete a transaction even if I fail to provide my name or other particulars. So I never do. And I have instituted another policy. I don't use credit cards. There are 3 reasons for this. First, if I have already paid for something, I can enjoy it more than if I have to worry about the bill every time I see it or use it. Second, I live within my means and do not build debt that will come back to haunt me. And third, every credit card transaction adds to that computerized data floating around in the ether of the internet. Using a credit card is the same as giving my name. So here are 3 words for all you listeners who want to keep good credit and strike a blow for privacy, however small. Always pay cash.
Lake Effect SAS Avram Lank was an award-winning reporter and columnist at the Milwaukee Sentinel and Journal Sentinel for more than 35 years. He lives in Whitefish Bay, and his freelance work has appeared in Milwaukee Magazine and Corporate Report, Wisconsin Magazine, among other places. 30 Americans is the title of the Milwaukee Art Museum's latest visiting exhibition. We'll talk with one of those Americans when Lake Effect returns in a moment on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. The 30 Americans show, which features works from the Rubel family collection, opened at the Milwaukee Art Museum last month. The show features the work of 31 contemporary African-American artists working across a variety of media, including painting, sculpture, prints, photographs, collages, and assemblages. Hank Willis Thomas is one of the artists represented in the show. In this exhibition, the photographer and filmmaker uses the language of advertising to explore how African-American men are represented in our culture. His photographs are bold, striking, and provocative. Thomas and Lisa Sutcliffe, who is the curator of photography for the Milwaukee Art Museum, joined me in the studio as the show was opening. Hank and Lisa, welcome to Lake Effect. Thanks so much for coming by.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
This is such a wonderful exhibit. And Hank, I want to start with your part in it. The way that you explore the commodification of black men in this country, the one that really sticks out, well, the two that really stick out for me, the Nike brand and also the leg of the basketball player with the chain on the basketball. And so what are you trying to look at? What do you want us to see through your photographs?
Well, as an artist, I just really am more interested in what people see than what I want them to see. I'm really interested in trying to encourage people to have discourse about things. So with those pieces, branded head and basketball and chain, I think some of the things that I'm trying to illuminate is this kind of way in which black bodies have been branded over time. How when slaves were branded as a sign of ownership, and today, you know, we brand ourselves in any number of ways, but also the way in which for so many people, the notion of ascending is through sports and entertainment. You know, and so a lot of times, even when we see successful African-American men in certain environments, we assume that they must be an athlete or an entertainer.
Are we branding ourselves without even realizing it, do you think? Is that part of it? Or, I mean, are your subjects colluding in this, do you think?
I mean, I think all of us are part of increasingly an incredible kind of amorphous commodity culture that we almost don't know how to exist without brands. You know, the name that's on the microphone or the name that's on the computer says something about us, you know, who we are, the way we think, the quality of individual we are. And so we can't help but to buy into it. And I think that's something that a great number of African-American male youth kind of were very keen to. And I think a lot of major corporations kind of capitalized off of that.
I'm just as guilty of that as everybody else. I just bought a new smartphone and I didn't think of it in terms of like, oh, this makes me a better person. But it does say something about who I think I am by having that thing. And so I've inadvertently branded myself without even thinking about it.
Even if something else is more functional, you know, it's just about – it's almost like joining a club in a sense. And I think, the cars we drive, and I really am kind of fascinated with how previous generations, they may have dealt with it on certain levels as far as what a commodity had and who had this. But now there's so many levels of nuance. And I think that we shouldn't take it for granted that a lot of major successful brands have benefited from being first embraced by African-American youth.
And I have to say probably the most – well, they're all striking. But the one that really kind of gets right to the nexus of that is your MasterCard piece, which takes that very famous trope of priceless and turns it utterly around. And this is a very personal piece for you, isn't it?
Yes. So, yeah, the piece, Priceless Number One, that's from 2004, and it was a picture taken of my cousin's funeral, and it lists a number of things that, you know, we had to – well, you know, there was like the suit, you know, $400, and I guess my cousin was killed when someone was robbing actually someone else for a gold chain, but that was, you know, like, I don't know, sold on the street for $400, and then there's, you know, any number of things, and then it says picking the perfect casket for your son, priceless. And what I thought was really an amazing kind of truly American experience was being in the funeral home with my family and watching them have to pick the right casket and looking at the price tags on the caskets and, you know, thinking about all of the kind of pomp and circumstance or whatever that goes into performing the right kind of going home ceremony. So even in mourning or grieving, we're still being marketed to, and I was really fascinated by that.
And I was also thinking that advertising, for all of its ill in the world, has also been a place for photographers, particularly and designers, to really explore and experiment, and it's offered a platform. So there's this kind of almost, I would think, like a love-hate relationship with advertising and with that commodification. But it's also a place, like I think of the Avedon photos, and that they were advertised, but they're beautiful. They're also works of art in themselves. So, you know, you're kind of creating art at the same time as you're being commodified.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if there's anything wrong with advertising except for the fact that it's so pervasive. You know, I think the issue is that it's kind of overweighted in its value and its presence in our lives. And I guess what I'm really interested in doing and using my position as a quote-unquote fine artist to actually kind of appropriate that language. Like advertising is the most ubiquitous language in the world. Why is it only used by a select group of corporations to speak to all of us? Why can't we use that same language and maybe even those same symbols to speak about other things that the corporations couldn't and shouldn't, you know, speak about? And I think there are, you know, any number of millions of incredible photographers and designers who all of their talent go into basically selling something that probably they're not that interested in. And so that's why don't more of them feel empowered to, you know, do that, but to do other things as well.
Well, Lisa, let's bring you in to the conversation now as well. How does Hank's work fit into this overall exhibit of 30 Americans, plus the 30 Milwaukee artists who are participating in this as well?
What's so great about this exhibition is that there's actually 31 African-American artists from the Rubel Family Collection. And Hank is one of them, and they were really interested in collecting emerging artists. And so they were meeting all of the artists and talking to them about their practice. And as they started to get to know the artists, they would then start to collect other artists who interested them and other artists who had influenced the artists that they were collecting. So the show ranges from someone like Hank to someone like Basquiat, who is really sort of a really fundamental figure in African-American art. So there's a real range of art in the exhibition, from Robert Colescott to Hank Willis Thomas to more minimal artists, David Hammons, and
who's the fellow who does the wonderful neon?
Oh, Glenn Ligon.
Yes.
Those pieces are fantastic. So there's a range of different practices, and it's a really interesting exhibition because it shows that there is a really diverse practice in African-American artists working today. And then there's a fantastic exhibition, Wisconsin 30, which is 30 African-American artists working in Wisconsin. So there's fantastic things to see in the museum, and the shows are both on view until September 8th.
How do you put together an exhibit like this and not make it seem marginalized, not make it seem like, well, the only reason we're seeing this is because we're putting all these folks together because they're African American and they happen to do art, as opposed to that they're artists first? Do you know what I mean?
Well, I think the title is really important. It's 30 Americans. And I think that, you know, you come to an exhibition like this and you see that these are all artists working in practices that are relevant in contemporary art, that their traditions relate to conceptualism, their traditions relate to minimalism, and they have ties to art historical traditions that reach out beyond just what you might think of as marginalized.
I think all exhibitions are based around kind of loose strands of connections between artists. And I think what makes this show unique is that it's actually the first kind of multi-generational survey show that's been exhibited of contemporary artists in kind of more mainstream institutions. And so that's kind of like a glaring gap from kind of what's been before. So,
and it's a nice glue that kind of holds it all together. Yeah.
And I think it's just as interesting as any other thing that you could choose to make an exhibition about.
How do you feel being a part of it?
I feel great. I'm on the radio.
And your work is on the wall, which is probably more important than that. But
it depends on the day. I mean, as an artist, I think you never make art thinking that people will ever see it or hear about it. So any opportunity to show your work, to have it responded to, or hear people listen to kind of what you have to say about it is really important, because most times when we exhibit our work, we actually don't get to hear what people, with 99% of the people who encounter it, think of it.
Well, have you had reaction to the pieces that are specifically here? I mean, what have people said?
There's been a pretty broad range of responses to the work in the show. Of my pieces, there was a pretty interesting debate in Birmingham, Alabama, when the priceless image was shown as a banner outside of the museum. And members of the African-American community were kind of took offense to that image because they thought of it as a real ad, which was kind of criticizing the African-American community. And that was really kind of a fascinating experience for me to recognize how, you know, your work can be interpreted outside of your own intentions.
Yeah, I imagine so, because I don't think that you probably had that in mind at all as taking advantage, you know.
No, it was just me trying to deal with my cousin's murder and rationalize the mourning process.
And I think what's interesting about your work, too, is that so many of the artists in the exhibition are taking conceptual art and doing it a little bit at a distance, and that yours has a much more personal anecdote to it, and that is something that makes your work unique in the exhibition.
The question bridge is also something that's running during the exhibition and is a fascinating, fascinating look at just how people see themselves and questions that they might have. How long is the full piece? I've only seen the clip.
Well, Question Bridge is a video-mediated kind of what we call megalogue between African-American men, where we have 160 participants kind of asking and answering each other's questions. And so what's on the display at the museum is a five-channel, three-hour video installation, but the content kind of is almost encyclopedic. So we're actually in the process of developing a interactive website for that right now.
So it doesn't matter when you go, it might be different.
Exactly.
So it's different parts of the pieces.
You can walk in at any point and experience any amount of time. And really, I think the thing is you'll get sucked in. You'll want to stay for about an hour or so at least. But you'll really experience the piece no matter when you walk into it.
What was it about asking those questions that you wanted to make this film? Talk to me about the genesis of that, because it's wonderful what I've seen.
Thank you. Well, there's three collaborators beyond myself. Chris Johnson, whose idea for Question Bridge, it came from, and then Biate Ross-Smith and Kamal Sinclair. But we were really interested in doing a project that wasn't about us. You know, it was about kind of the subjects. And so this project being called Question Bridge Black Males, it's really not about black men. It's about people, what happens when people are put into groups, how they relate to the notion of the group and relate to themselves as subjects of it. And what we were interested in seeing kind of when you ask someone who's part of a designated group to ask a question of someone else in that group, you already automatically are showing that there's diversity. And so with this project, we just asked complete strangers to ask questions of complete strangers within this group. And we wound up having over 1,600 question and answer exchanges, which was really just fascinating to see how much diversity was it within kind of this supposed pool of African-American men. So for any given question, we'd have five or six very different or relevant answers rather than a quote-unquote best answer.
Were there questions that kept coming up over and over?
Ironically, maybe there was like five questions that came up twice, but not even
that.
And that was still, yeah, we have over 200 questions, which that alone speaks to kind of the individuality that exists within a demographic.
Right. And the danger that we have of placing any of us into a broad brush group.
Yeah. And I think that ties back to what I'm interested in about marketing, in that, you know, anytime you market to a demographic or a gender, et cetera, like you are creating a pool of prejudices that you are basically trying to train people to want to fit inside of a box. And I've never really wanted to be in a box. And I'm really interested in trying to, even though I might always be in it, try to, you know, shine greater light on the boxes I'm put in and you know, trying to ask questions about why.
Or maybe connecting the boxes together at least so that you can move.
Or making bigger boxes.
Making bigger. Exactly. More spacious boxes. Yeah, I think you're right. I think we're all in boxes no matter what. But, you know, it's the idea of like trying to break out of them.
Yeah, and the beauty of the Question Bridge project is that you realize that, okay, actually we're in – any given person is in probably 100 boxes at once. But And it's only about what you decide to preface first. So we could have done Question Bridge fathers, Question Bridge, you know, single – parents, Question Bridge, you know, uncles, Question Bridge, doctors, lawyers, any number of things, and possibly had a great amount of the same participants. And I think that's what's fascinating about kind of when we talk about things about black, male, they're supposed to signify things, but they actually don't really say much about us at all.
And I think one of the things that makes that piece so successful is that you have such a range of different people answering the questions, that you get such a diversity in the answers, that you start to realize that there is no such thing as black male in a way, that having that category isn't really even a category.
Right. And I'm just really excited to be exhibiting it at the Milwaukee Art Museum. And I'm really grateful to Lisa for bringing it because it's traveled a lot. But this is probably one of the most exciting venues that we'll have had a chance to exhibit in.
And when I first saw it, I saw it at the Oakland Museum in 2012, and I I sat down and I walked in, and I would say there were about 50 people in the room from age 7 to age 85. And I sat there for 3 hours and no one left the room the entire time I was there. And after I finished watching the piece, I sent Hank an email and I said, this was really fantastic. And so I'm so excited that we were able to bring it here.
And I will say, like, even for video art that, like, we love, we tend not to spend more than 5 minutes in it. And that's mm-hmm. how we tried to edit it in, like, 5-minute bites. So we're ecstatic that people tend to stay a lot longer. So if anyone out there does choose to come, there's only, like, a 5-minute required.
It's okay. Yeah. Well, this is a magnificent exhibit. Hank, thank you for your participation in it. And Lisa, thank you for helping to coordinate all of this. Thank you both so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hank Willis Thomas is one of 31 African-American artists whose work is currently on view at the Milwaukee Art Museum in the 30 Americans exhibition. Lisa Sutcliffe is the curator of photography at the museum. As a compliment to the national show, the museum has also mounted a Wisconsin 30 exhibition. Both exhibits remain on view until September 8th. There's more information at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. 150 years ago, from the 1st through the 3rd of July, 1863, the Battle of Gettysburg was fought. We'll commemorate the battle that is often described as the turning point in the American Civil War when Lake Effect returns in a moment on WUWM.
Just before the battle, Mother, I am thinking most of you. While upon the field we're watching, with an enemy in view.
It's Lake Effect on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. It's great to have your company. 150 years ago, over the first 3 days of July, one of the fiercest and most important battles of the American Civil War was fought. The Battle of Gettysburg was the deadliest battle of the Civil War, with more than 35,000 soldiers killed, wounded, or missing in the first 2 days alone. It was also a turning point for the Union forces. Wisconsinites saw action in many of the American Civil War's fiercest and deadliest battles, including Gettysburg. 6 infantry regiments were there 150 years ago, including those in the Iron Brigade and a company of sharpshooters. Historian Thomas Martin Sabatke takes us back to July 1, 1863, the first day of the battle, and, as Sabatke explains, the start of the Iron Brigade's last stand.
Oh, the Jubilee is coming, don't you sniff it in the air. And 63 is the Jubilee for free men everywhere. Oh, the Jubilee is coming. No, just
at Gettysburg, the role of the Iron Brigade is paramount again. And I think it's their last really great contribution to Union victory. We can honestly say here in Wisconsin that without any contradiction, that the Iron Brigade saved this republic. They weren't the only ones that did it. But without them, I don't see the Battle of Gettysburg being won. And it was a battle where the Confederates, if they won another great victory, might win the entire war. The Eastern Army of the Potomac had been whipped in battle after battle. They were kind of like 0 for 3 in the last battles, and their confidence level was low. And the Confederate Army under Lee was so... This was about the time when their strength was their best. They were extremely confident. They got way into southern Pennsylvania, 8 miles across the Maryland border, to this little town, a crossroads town at Gettysburg. And some cavalry under General Buford had been holding up the Confederates. A New York brigade commanded by Lysander Cutler, who I might have mentioned at Bronner Farm, is now commanding this New York brigade that they're going to argue with in the 1880s. He himself is originally from New York, but had moved to Wisconsin. But he's there. But they get torn up by the initial Confederate onslaught. And as somebody in the 56th Pennsylvania and Cutler's brigade admitted to the Iron Brigade, as a matter of fact, we ran like sheep. And onto that situation comes the Iron Brigade. Naturally, they send the 2nd Wisconsin in first, into some woods called McPherson's Woods. There's a brigade of Tennesseans in there. It's 10:30 in the morning. And General Reynolds, who commands a whole wing of the Army of the Potomac for General Meade, the new commander, the last thing he'll say in this earth is to tell the 2nd Wisconsin, get those fellows out of those woods. And they line up and they are loading their muskets on the run. They haven't stopped running. They have to get to this battle before the high ground beyond town is taken by the rebels. Reynolds' strategy is to fight a fighting withdrawal on that first day of Gettysburg until the rest of the Union Army can come up and occupy the high ground south of the town, beyond the town. And so these guys are, can I say this? They're sacrificial lambs. But they're not going to act that way. They are going to do something awesome on July 1st, 1863, that the nation largely ignored. And what they do is bigger than Bronner Farm. Now they are on the great stage of history for all time. This is it. It's one of those this is it moments, and they know it. Men go in those woods to meet some veteran Tennessee men, a rifleman. And the Tennessee boys have seen them before. And they say, it's them damn black hat fellers. And they're swearing and cussing. They let out a huge volley on the 2nd Wisconsin, two different regiments on one Union regiment. And about 110 men or more of that 302 men that went into those woods go down on the very first series of shots, that within a split second. Their colonel, Lucius Fairchild, who is a firm anti-slavery Wisconsin guy, an incredible Union man, is shot in the arm and has to be taken from the field. Reynolds goes down. Some of his officers go down. Now, to the shock of General Archer's brigade, which is mostly Tennesseans who are veterans, that volley that has so staggered the 2nd Wisconsin doesn't stop them. Any other regiment would have just ran. When one-third of your guys go down in a split second, I think you're losing. If you know better, you'll run. They didn't. They kept coming and reloaded and got off a terrible volley with two-thirds of the remaining 2nd Wisconsin on the Tennessee troops. Then the Tennesseans looked to their right from the woods, and there was the 19th Indiana and the 24th Michigan wrapping around their flank, and they ran down the hill. And you can go through those woods today, and you can walk down, and you can see what a horrible position they would be in if they were flanked. And they ran down across a little creek called Willoughby Run and up onto another hill. And you know what? The 2nd Wisconsin and the other Iron Brigade troops ran after them at the run, and they captured hundreds of them. And they marched those guys through the streets in the late morning of July 1st. That made the Gettysburg citizens think, we must be winning. And the rest of the day, things would not go well that way. But it was the Iron Brigade that had done that. Then they realized, we're way out in front of the whole army that's coming up here. We better pull back to the woods where we were. And they crossed the creek again. Now, normally what you do is you pull those guys out of the fight. They're tired. They've used up all their ammo. Usually they get 40 rounds. They probably use 20 or 30. But they were reprovisioned with rounds. There was a noon lull. And then they fought Tennesseans and whooped them, okay? At the same time, the 6th Wisconsin had fought a group of Mississippians in a railroad cut further to the north, about a quarter mile or half mile north of that position of the 2nd Wisconsin. They had joined with a New York regiment from that other brigade, and they had crossed about 300 yards of pure death. They lost half their men. But Rufus Dawes, who himself was the great-grandson of William Dawes, who rode with Paul Revere. You see why these guys want to fight for the Union? It's personal. In the 19th Indiana, you got the grandson of Alexander Hamilton. This is what you've got. These men know what is at stake. This is not today. It's Americans don't get it. You know, they don't say, why would they fight so much? Who cares about the United States? They cared. They died for this. This abstract idea of liberty. This is not something abstract to them. This is real. Their forebears made this country, and they want to keep it at all costs. What Dawes did, Rufus Dawes did, who had become a colonel, he originally was just a captain. You get promoted when the other guys get killed. And he had never been wounded even in many fights, and he was worried about that. But he sent one part of his regiment, a company, into this big ravine, which is a railroad cut, where the railroad was unfinished, and gave natural cover to the rebels. That's why they lost so many men going across this open ground. It was deadly. I mean, you shouldn't even try it, but they just went and did it. They were ordered to go and try to blunt this other Confederate brigade that had made the other Union brigade that was ahead of them run into the woods up ahead. And they went ahead and got them. But this one move by Dawes, getting a company into the ravine and firing the length of the railroad cut right into the Confederates, turned the tide. And there was this moment where what's left of his regiment and a New York regiment to his left are cocking their muskets and ready to continue the fight and fire a volley, right? And the other guys are ready to fire a volley back. And it's kind of like, well, who has the upper hand? Well, there's that company firing down the length of this ravine. That helps convince the Rebs they're not going to win. The rebels actually have more guys in that railroad cut by numbers. And you've got a few scattered shots. You have a struggle where a couple of six Wisconsin guys are killed trying to get the flag of the second Mississippi. And then a third big guy goes in there and just gets it. And Dawes is one of many officers who's basically say, surrender or die, or something like that. We've got you. And they agree. And they get a whole bunch of Mississippians captured. The rest go running like sheep the other opposite way. They've been running down the railroad cut, and that threat is over. Now, about 2 o'clock, they fight a brigade of very plucky Virginians who are fresh. They haven't fought yet today, on July 1st, and they whoop them and drive them back through the woods again. They're not done yet. They have to reform. The rebels are making their great last effort on July 1st. They are going to have to fight a third time. This is unbelievable. This is incredible. You almost never see this. And they're winning. They win the first fight. They win the second fight. And they have one at the end of the day before they punch out. And they're in front of a Lutheran theological seminary, with a brigade on either side. They have Battery B, which had always fought with them, right close by. There's a 5th Maine battery that's really stout. Somebody had been working for them to pile up some lumber and trees, you know, to give them some cover. The 24th Michigan really becomes the center of the brigade for this last fight. They earn their spurs finally. If there are any holdouts as to whether they're good, the 24th Michigan loses 9 color bearers. And then Colonel Morrow, who is an unbelievable figure and beloved by the brigade by now, grabs the 24th Michigan's colors and defiantly basically says, we're going to stand or die here. He's letting everybody know we're not going anywhere. And the rest of the brigade forms up on either side of the 24th Michigan. Now, a whole new brigade, mostly of North Carolinians, in another division of Confederate troops that have been brought up, they get to fight, you know, sort of like you get to, it's sort of a sample pack, threesome here, three for one in a battle. And that's not good, though, because this is deadly serious. And they really whoop them good. They stagger them and drive them back. And then they look, it's 4 o'clock, and then they look to their right, and all the Union troops are running. And they look to their left, and all the Union troops are running, because the Confederates have deployed about 6,000 more men than the Union has on the field. And if everybody makes a big long line, the guys with more guys are going to be able to outflank the other army, which is what happens a little before 4 o'clock, depending on whose pocket watch you consult. And the Iron Brigade has the distinction of being the last unit off the field on the first day of fighting at Gettysburg. They are one of the few units that has to be ordered to retreat. They hadn't planned on going anywhere. They looked at all these guys running, and they just stayed. They stood their ground. One 24th Michigan volunteer was badly wounded in the leg and wasn't to be taken to the hospital, one of the buildings on campus of the seminary, to basically have to be attended to later. And he was biting cartridges and passing them up to his comrades so they could fire faster. I mean, that was going on all along the line. You couldn't put this into a movie because no one would believe it.
Thomas Martin Sobotky is the voice of our Civil War series, Iron Brigade and Beyond. He's a historian, teacher, and author of the novel Richmond's Bloody Road under the name Thomas Martin Saturday. He's also the author of Across That Dark River, The Civil War Memory. And as we remember the 150th anniversary of the Battle of Gettysburg, we thought we'd listen back to a remarkable in-studio performance by the Madison Band, Count This Penny. The song is called Do Not Borrow Trouble, and Amanda Rogel explains how the song came to be.
I wrote the song, and also a Civil War soldier named Walter Persons wrote that song, because we were asked by the Wisconsin Veterans Museum to create some songs based on archival letters. And so I was looking through the letters of Walter Persons and basically just stole things from them word for word. They were so beautifully written. I mean, he was like this young 18-year-old kid writing to his parents. And so, yeah, I just took it.
Father, mother, ever dear, I'm your unworthy son. I seat myself to tell you of ground we have won. We look for a fight at Shiloh in the black heart of Sesedge. There's 100,000 soldiers here and we can get no rest. And we can get no rest. I'll bear it like the others do and whisper no complaint. We're a mile from the Tennessee River where the peach trees bloom and sway. I'm way down south in the land of cotton, that's more than some can say. That's more than some can say.
Alan and Amanda Ragel are the husband and wife duo that is Count This Penny. They play Do Not Borrow Trouble for Us, written by Amanda, with words provided by Wisconsin Civil War soldier Walter Persons. That was in our studio last year. The band is coming to Milwaukee on July 13th to play at River West Public House. There's more information at WUWM.com/Lake Effect. And that is all the time we have today. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for joining us. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned now. Fresh air comes your way next.
The ground that we have.